Now let me turn the microphone over to Professor John Kaplan, visiting professor here at Harvard Law School, but the Jackson Eli Reynolds Professor of Law at the Leland Stanford Junior Law School, who will introduce this evening's guest.
We Californians must stick together. And I suspect for that reason, and only that reason, I was asked to introduce Judge Wapner. I consulted Judge Wapner on the introduction I should give him, and he said, as I would have said in similar circumstances, keep it short. And the theory being that every word I say is a word that he won't get a chance to say. As a result, my introduction will be very short. Judge Wapner is the judge of People's Court. You've all heard of him. Those who've seen People's Court have admired him, and now the time has come to listen to him. Thank you.
Had my gavel here, I'd have rapped for order. People ask me about that gavel. I was on the bench for 20 years, didn't own a gavel, never used one. Got on the People's Court using a gavel. Thank you, Dr. Kaplan, for that introduction. I did tell him to make it short. I didn't tell him to make it that short. They tell me this is the oldest building on campus, and I guess it's appropriate for the speaker here that you've got. There was a cartoon in a legal journal recently, and it shows a judge on the bench and two people pleading a case before him. And the caption of the cartoon says, "I don't give a damn what Judge Wapner said." They also tell the story of this drunk that was at a play, sitting in the first row. And after the first act, curtains came together and the manager came out, parted the curtains. He said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we have to cancel the performance. The leading man just dropped dead." Whereupon the drunk said, "That's all right, just give him some chicken soup." And the manager said, "But you don't understand, sir, he's dead." "That's all right, just give him some chicken soup." The manager says, "I told you he's dead, it won't help any." And the drunk says, "It's all right, wouldn't hurt him any either." The point of the two stories is, it's pretty rough when you have to explain your own stories. But I hope that when I'm through that you do give a damn. And even if you don't, it really won't hurt any. I come to you as a trial judge a little over 20 years. I've heard cases ranging from small claims, which was my first assignment on the bench, the claims involving millions and millions of dollars. I'm in the Guinness Book of World Records, I'm told, by one of the litigants whose home is just outside of Washington, D.C., that I settled the largest divorce case in the history of California. I wouldn't normally tell what the case involved, but it's in the Guinness Book of World Records, so I can tell you they divided some $100 million. And I also come to you as a judge who was presiding judge of the Los Angeles Superior Court, in charge of the entire court, and who managed the calendar. And I was also president of the Statewide Judges Association. I tell you these things not out of any braggadocio, but only to tell you that I have had some experience in the courts, so what I'm about to talk about I think may have some relevance to you. I do believe that we in the legal community, and by the legal community I do include professors, law students, bar associations, and judges, I think that we are forgetting the essential reasons for the existence of our courts. Our courts were established to serve the interests of all the people, and I underscore all. We want to have equal justice for the rich and for the poor and for the black and the white and the yellow and the red, whatever. We want justice for every human being within our land. There is one class, I think, that has been discriminated against, and it is the great middle class. Why do I think that they have been discriminated against? Well, the very poor are eligible for legal services. We have public interest law firms that take care of them. Maybe not always as well as we would like, but at least that's what they're for. And then we have the very prosperous who can afford lawyers, the very best. And I hope that some of you will be with those firms when you graduate, as I'm sure you do. But this large middle class that I'm talking about has been discriminated against because they're the ones that have the cases in court that may range between $15,000 and $50,000, you know, give or take a little bit. It may seem like a lot of money to you, but the lawsuits that are filed and the value of the dollar being what it is, they don't amount to much. But because of discovery, with its endless pages of interrogatories, and that's probably what you'll be doing as a first-year lawyer if you go with some big firm, but there's the first set of interrogatories, and there's the second set of interrogatories, and the third set of interrogatories, and it goes on, ad infinitum, ad nauseam. And then there are depositions. And you take the deposition of the litigant, and then you take the deposition of the witnesses, and then you find out something in the deposition that you want to know about, and you take a second deposition, and then there are motions to compel answers because the other side doesn't want all the answers to come out. And all of these things are deemed necessary by lawyers because they represent the interests of their clients. They want to do the very best that they can for their clients. That's what you're supposed to do. That's the oath that you take, and you have to follow that. But what it does, it makes litigation almost unaffordable for this great middle class. By the time you send out the interrogatories and do all the paperwork and then answer them, you can be papered to death. And we have these copy machines that go on, and it's endless. You've probably used a few already in your time. The very rich, they can do it. I tried a case just recently. I do things other than the People's Court. It involved two giant corporations. Well, by the time the case came to me, all the discovery had been done, and they wanted to just try the lawsuit. But they could afford the expense, and they also had the stability to accommodate the delay. There are other examples of this kind of thing where the cases lend themselves to a lot of discovery, where it's absolutely necessary, at least we think it is. You may have a products liability case or a personal injury case where the injuries are horrendous. Products liability cases take a great deal of digging to find out why a product was either defective, why it was manufactured in an improper way, or whether the design was not proper. And also there are cases of antitrust, there are fraud cases, there are class action suits, things that don't lend themselves to simplicity. Well, about this time, you're probably saying to me, Judge, why are you talking to a bunch of law students and maybe some faculty about this kind of an issue. What do we care? We want to graduate, we want to pass a bar exam, and we've been struggling for all these years, and we'd like to get out there and make a buck. And I say, yes, you're entitled to do that. But I also say that we are looking to you, and I say we, I'm talking about those of us in the legal profession who are interested in justice for all people. We're looking to you who are in the prestigious law schools for ideas, for some initiative, for some innovation. Fellows like myself who have been around the block a few times, we forget a little bit about what's going on in the real world. And as we get older, we become more set in our ways. And we are not thinking as young America is thinking. So we need the benefit of your wisdom, your understanding, and your initiative. What we really should be striving for, and what we have completely forgotten, in my opinion, is the need to determine controversy and conflict. We need to dispose of that controversy and conflict in a relatively simple way. And what we've done instead is to just get more complex as we've gone along. Society has become complex. The tools that we work with have become complex. We're flying to the moon. There'll soon be space law, if there isn't already. I haven't learned any, but I'm sure there's going to be plenty of it. But what I want you to do, and what I want you to think about, is what are we going to do for the people in the middle who can't afford the kind of justice that maybe you've been taught at Harvard? You're taught legal theory, by and large. I know there must be some practicum, and I'm sure there is. But by and large, you're taught about all of the highfalutin legal theories that there are, and if there isn't a case, you'll dream up one. What I want you to do is to dream up some of the things that are going to help most of the people most of the time. There have been some things that have been thought about. One of them is the alternative dispute resolution mechanism. I'm sure that you've all heard of it. And the fundamental goal of this program is to help citizens resolve their disputes with as little involvement with a formal legal system as it is possible. One of the problems involved in that, however, is that some people think that by doing what ADRM is doing, is to create second-class justice. I don't know if it is or if it isn't. That often can be in the eyes of the beholder. But of course, in working with these programs and in trying to make them work, we have to assure the people who are involved that they aren't getting second-class justice. But these disputes, by and large, are for the lower economic strata of people. They're for the poorer classes. And I think that to develop these things is fine. But as I say, what I think we've done is to forget the middle strata. We have used three things in developing this alternative dispute resolution mechanism. We've used mediation. We've used conciliation, and we've used arbitration. And all three are fine. The question is, do we go far enough with them, and are we, in effect, helping enough people when we use these programs? We use the programs, I think, for three reasons. One, we do want to relieve the court of court congestion. We do want to improve access for disputes and for disputants who cannot economically afford the court system. And we want to strengthen a process that is perhaps socially and psychologically superior to the traditional methods that we have used. I think that the most widespread facility for using ADRM is the Neighborhood Justice Center. We have currently over 200 such centers. Some of them are affiliated with law schools, and we've done a great deal of good with them. I think one of the finest that I have heard about, one of the most successful of these programs, is right here in Boston. I don't know if any of you are affiliated with it. I hope that you are, and if not, perhaps some of you would consider doing that. Of course, there is, within the court system itself, what is now my essential bread and butter, I suppose, and what some of you do watch on occasion, that's the People's Court. And it is really a small claims court. It is true that I try them as an arbitration because the people sign an agreement in advance to be bound by my decision. And there is no appeal, obviously. But isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful? The small claims court is good for several reasons. Certainly is easily accessible. One can come to trial within a relatively short time in California from 4 to 6 weeks after you file the complaint and then serve the complaint. The costs certainly are low. It only takes $6 to file a complaint. It costs $14 to serve it by the marshal, and you're in court ready to try your lawsuit for a sum up to $1,500. You get an effective hearing. And in California, you have to have self-representation. I don't think that's taking money away from lawyers, because lawyers generally, even first-year lawyers, can't afford to take a case to small claims court, take a day away from whatever they're doing, and represent someone. You can't do it unless you're doing it for the experience, and you don't get that much experience in small claims. There's something else that I think you should know about the California statute that I think is exceptionally good. And that is, not only involves money up to $1,500, but the statute provides for equitable relief. You can get a rescission, restitution, reformation, and specific performance. And you can't even do that in a municipal court in California, where you can sue up to $15,000. You can't get equitable relief, but you can in a small claims court. There is also, at the other end of the spectrum, there's what I call private judging. Private judging has several advantages. First of all, it takes a case out of the courts because it involves, it does involve generally a great deal of money. It allows the litigants to hear their cases quickly. It's at the convenience of the litigants, the attorneys, and the witnesses, and you don't have to wait for a courtroom in the courthouse. But this, again, while it may be a good system and take some of the cases out of the court establishment, it doesn't help where I'm concerned, and that is with the great bulk of middle-class people whose claims are not being adjudicated properly. There's also a program in the state of Michigan, well, in Wayne County, Michigan. I was at a judges' conference 2 weeks ago, spoke there, and they have a mediation program. They charge $75 for going through the program. But there again, it's designed to cut down the backlog of cases and the cases that go to trial. It doesn't concern itself with the process and the simplification of the process. The cases come to mediation only after they have gone through all the discovery and built up their case so that they are now ready to go to a three-person panel and have that panel place a value on the case. And all of the cases in the system go to mediation, so that you don't save anything. It's economically not feasible, again, for the person in the category that I've talked about to get their case heard in an economical and simplified way. Now, what I have found, I don't know whether you agree with me or not, but if you read the papers and don't have your head in the sand, you probably have found, as I have, that the average American citizen is just unable to afford the legal services that he or she needs. And if the rule of law is to be respected, the average citizen must be provided with a means to enforce his or her rights. Public opinion is against the complexity of court proceedings. It's against the rules. It's against formality. In conclusion, let me say this. The ADRM programs that I've talked about certainly are fundamentally different from the judicial system. They are structured loosely, and the procedures can be expanded. They also may be contracted to accommodate the issues that are in dispute. I also think that they can be made to handle more complicated cases than they do. If used as a supplement to and in conjunction with specialized courts such as small claims, where, incidentally, I think that the jurisdictional limit certainly in California could be raised to $5,000, and I think it could be that way across the board throughout the country, I believe that we may well fulfill the increasing need for affordable legal services in this country. I have probably raised more questions than I have given answers to. Answers I have found out a long time ago aren't easy to come by. And that's why, and I hope you won't feel that I'm redundant, but I do feel that that is why your input is really vital. I'm not really isolating you as the only group that's interested, but you have a responsibility as a coming lawyer who will be working in the community. You have a responsibility to engage in dialogue with each other. Engage in dialogue with your professors, who should have more experience than you do in the practicum of the real world of practicing law. Some of them do, some of them don't. I'm not putting down the ones who don't. I merely say that they don't have as much to give you, in my opinion, as those who have practiced, as I think Professor Kaplan has. You wouldn't know it by the way he teaches, would you? You don't mind that, John, do you? No, I'm not through. But we are looking to you for possible solutions. So if what I have said makes any sense at all, please carry it with you to wherever you intend to practice law. Join a bar association. Give your input into that bar association as to how you want the courts run. Infuse the system and the judges who are on the bench with new ideas, with new vitality, with innovation, so that truly we can say that we are trying to have equal justice for all. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Judge Wapner. And now the time comes for the question period. Anything goes. You may even ask questions about showbiz, as distinguished from law, assuming the distinction is a clear one to you. Thank you. And Judge Wapner.
Thank you.
Yes. Why don't we assemble behind the microphones and we'll alternate.
Yes. I have two questions regarding...
Oh, he wrote them out, too.
No, I haven't written them out.
Oh, that's, all right, all right. That was a joke. It's all right.
No, what this is the logbook of a game
what
I
play. What is it?
This is the logbook of a
logbook.
Game I play, yeah. We play the Judge Wapner game.
Can it be marketed?
We tried. Actually, I called your producer, and he told me that Harvey Levin was publishing a book, and so we couldn't do anything like that because he had an exclusive.
He wrote the book. He's not publishing it.
Oh, yeah. Well, they had it right. Okay.
You'll get to your question before long. I've got about 20 minutes.
Well, what we do is we stop the video recorder after they present the first facts of the case, and we vote for the plaintiff or the defendant.
And how many of you vote?
We've voted about 125 or something so far, something like that. 100, at least.
No, I mean, how many people vote?
Oh, just me and my friend.
Oh. I'm wrong 50% of the time. I don't know.
Well, certainly 50% of the people don't agree with you all the time.
That's true.
As you said. One can also abstain, in which case you don't gain or lose a point.
I think this was a setup.
The first question concerns the Laverne Cattle Company case.
That's kind of an in-joke. Is this one of my cases?
Yes, this is one of your cases where the country music legend from the early 60s was accused of showing up at a gig drunk, delivering a substandard performance for which the owner of the establishment, Laverne Cattle Company, refused to pay. And I was very curious. Since the singer was exonerated of being drunk and giving a substandard performance, whether you might reveal his identity, if you remembered it.
That's an easy out. I don't remember it.
Second question.
Did you learn a lot from that first question and answer?
The case of the ill wind between neighbors, where the...
I don't remember the names of these things, you know.
Just the judge. Yeah, right. This is the case about the tall eucalyptus trees, the leaves of which blew into the neighbor's yard and stained his swimming pool.
Oh, yes. I do remember that, I think.
Right. That occurred on the date of one of the presidential debates, and when I set the machine up to record the debate, I inadvertently recorded over the disposition of that case. Since my friend abstained and I voted for the defendant, I wanted to know how that case turned up so we could score the point.
My best recollection is, because I've tried about 1,100 of these so far, and I don't keep a log as you do. My best recollection is it was for the defendant, and the plaintiff, I felt, had not only been damaged, but if he had, he didn't do anything to mitigate damages.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I got a point.
Judge Wapner, a couple of weeks ago, Time magazine reported that Justice Marshall likes to take off the afternoons to watch the people court. I was wondering if you've seen any of the themes that you've been developing on the court show up in recent Supreme Court opinions.
No, but I tell you this, I've always respected Justice Marshall, and since I read that article in Time magazine, my opinion of him has gone up considerably more.
That's a no, I guess. That's...
Pardon, sir?
Does that mean you haven't seen anything show up yet?
That means I haven't seen anything show up.
Okay, just on a serious note, we're here, Harvard Law students, and you're talking about small claims, mediation, and a lot of us are trained to wear pinstripe suits and white shirts.
You're trained what?
Trained to wear pinstripe
and
red and striped ties and go do $1 million deals. And where do you think someone like us fits into what you want us to do?
Well, no.
Was there a question mark at the end?
Pardon? The question's a serious one, and I want to try and give it a serious answer. there are places for you to do work other than what you do in the law firm that you go with. I assume most of you will be going with law firms. It is rare that I see anyone today open up a law practice of his or her own. It's a difficult thing at best. So what you want is a job that will pay you a decent salary commensurate with what a graduate of Harvard Law School should get. And then on the side, you can do either pro bono work, or you can join one of these neighborhood law centers and give advice to people who need it and try and mediate disputes. In the existing framework of what ADRM is, or maybe you'll come up with a better idea, with something that maybe can be done within the courts, as I've suggested in this case, between $15,000 and $50,000, where you want to try it. We tried that in Los Angeles, by the way. There was a program there designed to look at a type of case, as I've suggested, and what we did was to shorten the proceedings, cut out the interrogatories, lessen all of the discovery, depositions, and so forth. And after 2 years of trying the program, it failed. And you would ask me, well, why did it fail, Judge? And the only two answers that come to my mind. One, it failed because we lawyers as a breed generally are slow to change. We're stuffy, fuddy-duddy kind of people. And that's what I'd like you to get over the, you know, you've got to learn the fundamentals of the law and all of these brilliant theories and ideas, but you've got to get down to the common man, too. You can't lose the common man touch. So I want you to think. I can't tell you exactly what to do because, I've gotten past that stage. I'm not thinking as well as I used to. I want these young minds, these young brains, these brilliant people to come up with some of the things that I think you can do. So I know that's a long-winded answer to a very good question. I don't know if it'll suffice or not, but that's the best I can do.
Okay. That'll do.
Judge Whoa.
No, Wapner's the name, not Judge Whoa.
As a member of the Spartacus Youth League. No, just kidding. Just kidding.
Why, what is the Spartacus? Tell me now.
It's a joke.
Oh, okay.
My question is that we all realize that medical care is equally expensive as legal help, and they have insurance for it. I always wondered why there's no insurance policies for legal help.
Why? Because people haven't convinced the legislature that we should do it, or they haven't convinced the lawyers that they should be have such policies for people because insurance companies aren't creative enough to do something like that. Or if they are creative enough, they probably looked into it and feel people wouldn't buy it and it wouldn't be economically sound. So if you think it's a good idea and you get enough people to think it's a good idea and then you can interest some insurance company to put it forth and then try and sell it, then maybe that's a good idea. Then you've got to convince the legal firms to accept the fees that the insurance companies would say and set forth in a schedule, and that would be pretty tough. So you've got a lot of problems. I'm not saying it's not a good idea, but this is the kind of thing that's creative and needs working on and maybe has some merit.
Judge Wagner, I'm curious. I've heard a bunch of lawyers say that one of the ways to prevent the clogging of the courts that's taken place up till now is to adopt the English rule whereby if you lose, you pay your opponent's legal fees. Do you think that would be a good measure or a bad one?
Well, it has some merit, but it has to be given consideration because you've got to get into the reasonableness of it. If someone files a lawsuit that has absolutely no merit whatsoever, and a judge can make that determination, then under those circumstances, to pay someone else's legal fees would be great. Some appellate courts in California have given sanctions for frivolous appeals. They've imposed sanctions as high as $100,000 against the law firm. So that can be done. But what I don't like is a blanket kind of thing, that in every case the loser has to pay the other side's attorney's fees. There are a lot of lawsuits that are close. You file a lawsuit, you think it has merit, and you may lose. But that's just because some judge didn't agree with you. It doesn't mean the judge is necessarily correct. So I think if you put in a rule of reason and a reasonableness into it, then the idea may have some merit.
I have one more question. I know that the discovery rules were originally brought in to supposedly help poor plaintiffs, and it seems to me that they've been having, you know, just from what I've seen, they seem to be having the opposite effect. Do you think that the introduction of the discovery rules was a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's good in certain cases. Like I said, if you have a fraud case, in order to ferret out what the fraud is, you're going to have to dig, and it usually takes a lot of discovery. That's one thing. In a products case, in a medical malpractice case, you're going to have to do some discovery and digging. The problem is we use it in every case. It's across the board, and that's what I think is bad about discovery.
Thank you.
Again, it's the rule of reason, and it's gotten well beyond the rule of reason.
Judge Wapner.
One of my dinner partners.
Well, I have another question I didn't get to ask you at dinner. According to the program, you've spent 20 years in real courts listening to real lawyers and 4 years on the People's Court listening to ordinary, everyday people. Do you think that laymen, untrained in legal gobbledygook, make inherently better common sense than lawyers, or are they too emotionally involved to make any sense at all in People's Court?
The reason we don't have lawyers in small claims court and on people's court is because small claims is truly a people's court. We don't want lawyers in there. I object, Your Honor, I object. The reasons for the objection and so on. We want quick, simple justice. And that's why the California statute on small claims allows hearsay evidence. They allow affidavits, things that normally your evidence professor will tell you hearsay, and how come that judge on television lets that in? Well, he lets it in because the statute allows him to let it in. But the statute was designed specifically for that purpose. But people do get very emotional when they're pleading their own cases. In many instances, I've been accused of being very, very tough on people and very impatient because I'd ask a question and I don't get an answer. And then I ask it a second and third time and so on. And they want to tell the story the way they want to tell it. So they do get emotional, and it is difficult. But by and large, if they can be educated into what they need to do to bring a case to you, I think by and large, they're going to get justice. Because if a judge is patient enough to listen to both sides and to ask the proper questions and to ferret things out, eventually you're going to get at the truth most of the time.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes, sir. This is a short question. Is it true that Rusty the bailiff was the bailiff at the Charles Manson trial?
Yes, it is true.
Thank you.
He was a bailiff for 33 years in the Superior Court. He was also the bailiff in the Patty Hearst case. He was in charge of all the bailiffs as the sergeant of bailiffs when I was still on the bench, and I recommended him for the People's Court. He's got the greatest sense of humor anybody ever had.
Judge Wapner, who is Doug Llewellyn? And where on earth did you find him?
Doug Llewellyn was a reporter in Washington, D.C., and worked on a television station. When we did the pilot, there was another lady on there. There was a lady, I should say, who... Doug Llewellyn is married. He has two children. And I. There was a lady who did the pilot. The producers felt that they wanted a different kind of personality to do this. They found Doug Llewellyn. I don't know where they found him. And he has nothing to do with my decisions. And I don't tell him what questions to ask either.
Of the 1,100 or whatever you said number of cases, I was wondering if you could recite a favorite of yours.
Favorite? Well, since you're such a good audience and you laugh at almost anything I say, I tried one the other day. Very straightforward case as far as the plaintiff was concerned. He was suing because he took something into the defendant to be cleaned, I think it was, and it was ruined, and the defendant wanted to settle with him, and the plaintiff didn't want to settle. I am a great advocate of settlements, and I wish they'd settle, but he just didn't want to. So they had a big argument. Nothing physical, but they just argued. Well, the proprietor went home, the plaintiff having failed to settle, went home, stewing all night long, stewing it as he ate his dinner, stewing during the evening, finally went to sleep, and comes into court, and he files a countersuit. The countersuit is because while he was sleeping, he had a dream about this man and the argument, and he took a swing at the guy with a hard left hook. Instead of hitting the guy, he hit himself in the mouth and knocked his tooth out. Well, he filed a countersuit for $1,000 for the loss of his tooth. Now, you be the judge. How did I decide? I'll bet one of you will come up with a theory.
I have a quick question. At times on the show, you seem a bit...
He'll sue you for preempting his right.
You seem a bit testy and irritated.
That's what I just told the lady, yes.
Do you enjoy doing the show, or do people get you upset, or...?
Oh, I enjoy doing the show, but, you see, I run that... Aren't you going to let me answer his question? I am the judge in the court. I run the court just as I did 25 years ago when I ran small claims court in Los Angeles County. It's a volume court. You can't allow people to ramble on, be redundant, and tell the story the way they want to tell it. So on occasion, I suppose I get testy. That's just because Joe Wapner gets testy once in a while. I also think I have a sense of humor. And my wife doesn't think so. Incidentally, do you mind before you ask the next question? I'd like to introduce her because I want to thank all you people for inviting us here today. Yesterday was our 38th wedding anniversary. I would like to introduce my wife, Nikki. You don't want me to get testy, huh?
No. What I wanted to ask you, Your Honor, was...
Your Eminence.
Yes. do you really decide the cases during the advertisements? And does it depend on what is being advertised?
No, I don't. I can take as long as I need, seriously. By the time I walk off the bench, in most cases, I know pretty well what I'm going to do, and I just go back into chambers, which is my dressing room, and I write out a few notes as to what I want to say. Because what I am trying to convey to the general lay public is a little bit about basics of law. I want them to try and conduct their lives in a lawful way, and so they don't get it in the proverbial end. So I want to be sure that I'm laying it out, and I want to be sure of the law. So I would say, in most cases, I take 2 to 5 minutes in doing this. See all these gray hairs? 25 years of doing it, I've got a feel for it, I think I know what I'm doing, and it really doesn't take that long. On the other hand, there have been cases that have been very complicated, and sometimes, now when we first started this program, I wouldn't get anything. You know, I'd say, where's your receipt? Where's this? Where's that? Nothing. Now they come loaded for bear. They come in with cases for me to read that have been Xerox. Yeah. Someone the other day brought in CC&Rs. You know what they are, covenants, conditions, and restrictions. And when you buy a piece of property, they're in a deed. And he was saying that these, in the covenants, conditions, and restrictions, there was a provision which made the defendant responsible for paying his share of road costs and so on. Well, at any rate, there are some times when I have things to read, so that takes time. I did take the other day an hour and 15 minutes to make a decision. that stupid judge. But it really was complicated. There were a lot of legal issues. I had to ferret them out, lay them out, and then come back. My decision was 8 minutes. That's a long time to give a decision, 8 minutes on television in a half-hour show. But this is not going to be a half-hour show. It's going to be a two-parter. Not by design. Not by design. And that's what, you know, this is not an answer to the question specifically, but it is the beautiful part of what these producers allow me to do.
When the doctor withholds the treatment, and negligence when the patient refuses it. I understand the technical legal distinction you're making. But the fact that so many doctors now think it is negligence is important, isn't it?
No, that's the fact you need.